Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking about the new book, The Plazas of Santa Fe. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Larry Littlebird. He's founding director of Hamatsa Indigenous Learning Center. He's a Pueblo Indian from Laguna in Santo Domingo, Pueblo. And he is the author of Hunting Sacred, Everything Listen. Deborah Roberts joins us by telephone. She's a master beekeeper, a natural beekeeping educator, a speaker, mentor, and writer. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, both of you.
Oh, hi.
It's so nice to be here. Yes.
It's great to have you. Now, the two of you on Sunday, October 23rd, are going to be doing an event at the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture called The Spirit of Bee. That's from 2 to 4:30 in the afternoon, and we'll be talking about that in just a moment. But I wanted to ask each one of you how you became a beekeeper and got drawn into the whole world of bees. How about you, Deborah?
The short story is my health fell to pieces, and I got my life back. I was sort of busy burning the candle at both ends many, many years ago, and when I took a sabbatical for 6 months that became the rest of my life, I ended up on Hopi, bringing honey to Hopi to thank a family whose father had died, Thomas Benyaka, who had made a huge impression on me with one encounter in the 90s, and I'd heard he'd passed, and I'd finished having a health crisis, but still had to rest a lot. So I thought I'd drive across country and from North Carolina and deliver honey to the family. And what happened was I didn't know them at all. I just somehow arrived at their door and said, "I'm Deborah Roberts. I'm here to deliver honey to you because of some profound thanks I feel inside for your father." And the woman who answered the door said, "Oh, my goodness, I had just told Thomas Benyaka Jr. that we're out of honey and I need to go to the store and get some more." So what I understood looking back on that moment is that something bee-ish sort of slipped under my radar and into the heart of my life. And by the following winter, I was in bee school here in Western North Carolina, and it just changed my life forever.
And so you started keeping bees as, it sounds like almost like a spiritual practice as well as a way to get honey.
You know what? I've only harvested honey once. I'm actually into the bees for the bees. I adore them like some people love their dogs and cats and grandmothers and partners and, you know, whatever. And I'm in it for the education. I'm in it for helping to, support the bees to make their best choices as the steward that I am so that they can survive in the world that it is. So I'm really, that's my territory. I have friends who do the honey thing and are commercial and are, you know, other wonderful folks. But my primary intent is bees for bees.
That's extraordinary. A few weeks ago, we had on the air Hannah Nordhaus, who wrote The Beekeeper's Lament, and that was about commercial beekeepers who go with just truckloads of beehives to almond groves and things like that and pollinate them and so on. And that, no judgment, I mean, that's how I get my almonds that I eat every day and all of that. But those bees, talk about worker bees. They're almost like, I was thinking they're almost like slave bees. I mean, we make those bees work.
It's there's an expression called busy as a bee that comes from the indigenous activity of a bee in its own right. When we are saying we've got colony collapse disorder in the world, which we do, the bees are having trouble living in the world, and then we send over 1.5 million hives in America west of the Mississippi into this whole nightmare situation that does involve the livelihood of a lot of people and, you know, people enjoying almonds and all the other fruits that are involved in that whole pollination route. When we look at that, it's we're letting the bees out of our hands in terms of stewardship for their whole season. That, you know, once they've gone to California to the holding yards in December, there's nobody there to go, how's the queen doing? Is there any disease going on? They're getting exposed to every disease under the sun, moon, and stars, et cetera, et cetera. So it's, I think it's a travesty and a nightmare. And I've come. I used to sob when I showed a picture of that in my lectures in the early days of understanding what that was. But I've circled around to deepening my commitment to education, which brings me to Larry Shores, because I'm such a longtime beloved fan of Larry and his wife Deborah and their work at Hamatsa. And I feel like in landing in those places with the events we're doing and the events and the work that they're ongoing doing and bringing bees back to the land. That's the hope. It's the little things that become the big things that turn all this big sort of nightmare stuff around, I think.
Larry Littlebird, tell us more about Hamatsa Indigenous Learning Center.
Well, when you start talking about the bees, you really can describe what Hamatsa is really all about. A healthy hive, if you can think in terms of a healthy hive. This is us, humans. And our hive is terribly in disarray and didn't just get this way overnight. And so what bees are constantly doing is making sure that all that work that they do is to just bring about a purity. That honey is such a I'm in it for the honey money. That's where the real draw is for me, is that the taste of honey and knowing that this is essentially an essence of such pure quality, and that these amazing creatures are here to provide this quality of purity, and it comes into our lives through a divine relationship, and that's essentially what Hamatsa is really about, is a piece of land that's ancestral land for us at Carisin-speaking people and at Santo Domingo. And it's come back into our stewardship. The stewardship of native people, not the stewardship so much of the pueblo, but individuals. And Hamatsa is a not-for-profit corporation. And so that little piece of land is a place where we can start over. Now, starting over is another thing that human beings have forgotten, because starting over is something that we always have the opportunity to do, but most people have forgotten that. They think of having to start over as having failed somehow.
Right, right.
But the reality is, our essential being.
No pun intended.
Yes, our essential being is very much modeled in a hive, and the bees have a capacity to always start over. All those bees that you spoke about, you know, that are trucked off to different parts of the country, those hives are just left most of the time. And once the bees have done their work, they're really not collected again and taken care of. They finished their work, so to speak. But the other bees that still have hives in other places, that work is going to continue, and the bees are going to remain. They'll be here once, you know, if we don't come back on track, bees will still be here. We might not be here.
One thing that I think is so important and just interesting is that, I mean, in these places where if you have a monocrop that blooms a few weeks out of the year, then bees only have that nourishment for those few weeks. So in order to have healthy bees that are in an adaptive environment, you have to have crops, flowers, etc., that are blooming at all different times, which means healthy bees and crop diversity or plant diversity go hand in hand.
This is exactly what we mean by indigenous learning. That's exactly it. Indigenous means you're part of a place. That is who you are. And most people have no sense of their being because they're not of a particular place. And bees, essentially, they provide a way in which to learn this. And it's the relationship that we can have as human beings to these little creatures. That they're not really an insect. And a lot of people don't really realize that. They're closer to us as a mammal than most people realize.
What do you mean? They're technically an insect.
Genetically, you can it can be disputed, and I'm not going to go into the science of
it.
But I don't particularly. I don't see them as an insect.
So they certainly form communities and have jobs and things like that, and form these incredible houses and structures and so on. And I was thinking about, Deborah, there you are in North Carolina with your beehives, and you treat the bees the way some of us treat our dogs and friends and so on. And yet you're having also trouble along with everybody else with these bee parasites and colony collapse disorder and those same things. It's a huge problem.
It is. One of the things about beekeeping, which is why those of us who are might call ourselves natural beekeeping can't call ourselves organic in most cases, is that bees, from the point they leave a hive, they can go, 2 to 5 miles to forage. So you might never use Roundup or certain chemicals in your own property, but you can't account for, that radius unless you really own a lot of land and have natural practices. So, unlike if you had a cows or goats or your dog or cat, in most cases you kind of know what's on your land, what you're feeding them, and where they are. Once a bee's left its own apiary, you don't have any control over that. So if there's spraying going on or, all the things that could be going on in the environment, they're going to bring home some of that. And what's interesting, sort of tagging onto something Larry's saying is, when you talk about indigenousness and sort of being connected to a place and what that kind of flowers within you and all that happens when you're connected with the bees, you come to know when you have bees what neighbors are walking towards you saying, wow, my gardens are doing better. Who's spraying, who's not. There's conversations there to be had if you want to have them. You're looking at the practices of spraying in the air, if that's happening in your community. And so you are, by nature of caring for the bees, putting yourself into a relationship of greater connectedness with, maybe more than you would have in your life. And it's a pleasure, and it's also sobering when you look at kind of some of the choices two-legged of us are making on planet Earth right now.
So you attribute the illnesses, besides the parasites, which are their own gigantic problem, to pesticides primarily?
Yes, I do. In North America, we put billions of pounds of pesticides into the soil annually, and a lot of these have a life much longer than the couple weeks or months of use that you might imagine, and they stay in the soil and they go into the water and they're there for years. And then the problems with the neonicotinoids, you'll hear that the systemic pesticides are, from my point of view, an even greater problem, because back in the day a bee would forage and rub on pollen and be in a flower that had been sprayed and bring some of that home on its body. Well, in addition to that, with the systemic chemicals, the stuff is in the nectars and in the pollens. So it's in the foods that the bees are bringing back that are fed to their own colony, that are fed to the forming bees, and that lodge into the wax cells, which, can last forever, which is why we have to recirculate or recycle, actually cut out some of the comb, every 4 years or so, those of us who are inclined to do that, because of what accumulates in the wax. And that's kind of almost a taboo practice, because it takes the bees so much work to create that the old-time beekeepers called, drawn comb gold, because of the work of bees to create that in the first place. And it could technically last for, a very, very long time. But a lot of us are starting to cut some of that out after so many years because of what's getting accumulated. So I definitely believe that's a big, huge problem. But in America, that's also a loaded situation with the commerce of chemicals.
We're talking to Deborah Roberts and Larry Littlebird.
And that's another, she's reminding me that another reason for wanting to have bees at Hamadza is that across the nation, some of the reservation areas are still the largest areas where there really isn't this kind of contamination, because the pesticides just have not been applied like they have been in other areas.
Very interesting. So you might have that 2-3-4 mile radius.
Yes, absolutely. And that's another reason why one of my interests is to help Native people understand how this relationship with bees can really help them prosper as communities as well. It could be a win-win situation for bees and humans, as both the story of the bee and the story of us as Native human beings.
The word bee now.
Yes, right. We can have a true bee in. Well, excuse me. But as our stories get told, possibly for the first time, there might be people who have an interest in listening. And that's the key, is the ability to listen. And that's why I love sitting across the table from you with that headset on, because I know that you're truly listening, and this is what this is really about. But it's like learning to listen to what the bees are really sharing with us.
Now, the two of you are doing this event called The Spirit of the Bee on Sunday the 23rd of October. And what will you be doing? What's the nature of the event?
Well, we're just going to get a buzz on, that's all.
Oh!
When Deborah and I get together, you can't help it. We're having something called a theatrical dialogue, and we talk in stories, and she's sharing the stories of her experiences with bees. I'm sharing my experiences with bees, coming from a Native perspective, an Indigenous perspective, and I believe that in the stories that we're going to share, passing them back and forth between us, that people can kind of grasp another kind of communication, something very tangible, because it's their present, and it's oral, and it's a word that we've found that has life, and it can come alive for a person, and This is why we're choosing this form of presentation rather than writing a book or doing a film or any of the other types of transferring information. This is direct, and that's what we're looking for.
And Deborah, I mean, you have been known to put your ears right up to the beehive. You really, literally and figuratively, listen to the bees.
Yeah, I had an experience with an old-time beekeeper that. Longer story than I have time for, but he awakened me to making sure I used more senses in my beekeeping than just visual. And so from the day I got my bees, he didn't actually talk about oral, but that's kind of where my go-to place. So I put my ear to my hives every single day. I live where my bees are. And that has been an unbelievable source of information. So, I'm having some amazing experiences in the bee yard that are both a blend of what I think most beekeepers do and then, some unique things that just come from my own unique experience. And what I love about what Larry and I are going to do is that when I think about, what his Indigenous bee stories are with the person that I know there, what I'm finding in my yard is a woman just doing the chop wood carry water experience, the day-to-day life in a bee yard. What's arising from that, largely from listening, it's what Larry's talking about, listening and observing the bees and letting them kind of tell me what they need and provide all these different rich experiences, that there's a sense of the sacred that's arising with my beekeeping practice that kind of puts a capital P in the practice. And I'm finding that the weave of women's ways in the yard is sort of circling around to what indigenous means to me. So it's the afternoon Larry and I are doing at the museum is going to be a wonderful revelation for me, because we know tentatively the territory we're each going to talk about, but there's going to be a fresh offering of telling the story really, you know, newly in front of each other as well as the audience, so thus the story dialogue. It'll be as enlightening for us as it is for everyone who comes, and that excites me a lot.
I have to say, Deborah, I can't believe you don't eat and harvest the honey, because, I mean, I eat honey every single day of my life. I eat raw honey. Oh, you eat it, but you don't harvest it?
I eat it till the cows come home, yes. I'm a recipient. We have amazing varieties of honey here in Western North Carolina, so I eat it. I just don't harvest it, and I'm not actually opposed to people doing that. I just am so into my bees wintering over what they have. And there have been, with some climate change and some different things happening in Western North Carolina, our area has experienced actually a little bit of dearth, which is some lack of enough food for bees to sustain themselves in pockets of our area. So this year we had one, a particular dearth year, and so there wasn't, if I'd wanted to harvest, my yard actually didn't have enough honey for me to do that. But, oh, yes, I eat it. And I'm going to bring some to the museum event.
So, Larry Littlebird, you are the founding director of Hamatsa Indigenous Learning Center. And we don't have time to talk in detail right now about what you do, but could we get you back sometime soon and talk about it?
Yeah.
That would be wonderful, because you do a lot of things there besides beekeeping.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the bees we're just getting started with. And, you know, it's 320 acres surrounded by 12,000 acres of undeveloped land, the tribal lands all the way around us. So that makes it a perfect place in which to begin to develop healthy hives. So
healthy hives and healthy food.
And healthy food, absolutely. Yeah.
So the event is The Spirit of Bee with Larry Littlebird and Deborah Roberts, Master Beekeeper. And for more information, people can go to hamatsa.org, and I'm going to spell it out, hamatsa.org. And it's very important for people to get their tickets to this event in advance, because you can't get them at the door. You have to get them in advance. The event, The Spirit of the Bee, is Sunday, the 23rd of October at the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture here in Santa Fe on Museum Hill. And if you don't have internet or any of that stuff, you can call 505-899-6028.
That's right. And the day before, the day before the 23rd, on the 22nd, we're holding the Spirit of Bee workshop with Deborah and I are holding that workshop at Hamadza. Again, go to the website to get directions on how to get there. And that starts at 9 a.m. to 5 p.m.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So there is a workshop for those people who would be interested in finding out more about what is a healthy hive, how do you get started, and what is this spirit
of
bee?
Of bee.
Yes.
Well, that only has 20 spaces. The event at the museum is larger, but the event at Hamatsa is just for 20 people. So I would encourage people to register sooner than later. It's going to be a lovely, lovely event.
Well, thank you both so much for being with us, Larry Littlebird and Deborah Roberts, on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Chris Wilson and Miguel Gandert. They are co-authors. Well, Miguel is a photographer and Chris Wilson, author of The Plazas of New Mexico, a brand new book about which there will be a panel discussion on Sunday, October 16th at 2 in the afternoon at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium here in Santa Fe. It's free and open to the public and will be followed by a book signing. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's great to be here.
Thank you.
So the plaza is a phenomenon that goes back, well, centuries if not millennia. Let's talk about the plaza in New Mexico going back as early as the plazas in Indian pueblos. What are the first plazas that we know of?
Well, the first ones are probably about 700, and they're people starting to build...
The year 700,
yeah. And they're building villages of, one or two dozen mast rooms, often an L-shape or a crescent shape facing southeast, with the packed earth in front where they cook their food and socialize. That's the first kind of plaza space. By the year 1000, 1050 in Chaco Canyon, Pueblo Bonito, these are several hundred room buildings, three, four stories, very tightly defined around a plaza. The rooms are terraced, and they step down, and they really look at the dance plaza, and they look at the space where the circular kivas are. So it's a, you know, it's a millennia-old tradition.
And what were the different functions of the plaza? I mean, we're talking ritual, and we're also talking everyday life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and we're talking Pueblo and Hispanic plazas, Anglo courthouse squares, and the cultures have different takes. The Pueblo one is residential because it's residential room blocks around the plaza, which is a space for a cycle of ritual dances, maybe 35 dances through the course of the year, and there's a great religious focus and intensity. The Spanish plazas also are residential courtyard houses surrounding them, and then the church is right there, so they also have a strong religious identity. There's a shift to a secular, capitalist culture in the Anglo courthouse squares. Obviously, the courthouse, government's at the center, but surrounded by business blocks with commercial storefronts on the ground floor. But then above, the offices of the attorneys and the land surveyors and the real estate companies that have business in the courthouse. So it's kind of an alliance between government and commerce.
It was striking to me, looking at this book and reading what you wrote, how much more apparently similar the Native American and Spanish uses of the Pueblo were than the Spanish and the Anglo uses of the Pueblo.
Mm-hmm. That's true in what I just said, the more religious residential scale. When you get to the villas, the administrative center, so Santa Fe, Santa Cruz up by Española, Albuquerque, and then El Paso del Norte, which is now Juarez and was part of New Mexico, you've got a government component. So you've got the Palace of the Governors, you've got the offices of the government officials there. There are commonalities between the Hispanic and the Anglo. So for instance, the church sits on the high side of the plaza in the Spanish tradition, and you have a kind of formal axial ascent up into the church. And a similar kind of Euro-American thing goes on with the courthouse, where you're going up the steps and doubling back, and you're ascending, in that case, not to a religious chamber, but to the courtroom.
So how have, in the last few hundred years, how have the uses of the plaza changed? I mean, plazas seem to go through states, and of course it's not the same for every town in New Mexico either, but they seem to go through states of ascent and then just decline and decay and then rejuvenation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, if we look back about 150 years ago, a big change was that the original Spanish plazas were packed earthen multipurpose spaces. The militia could muster there, a market could take place, there could be a religious procession. And starting in Santa Fe in 1863, the first plaza park went into one of those spaces. So it starts to take on less of a mixed use and more of a public celebration, everyday amenity of being able to sit in the plaza. And then, of course, the rise of the automobile and the way in which our whole culture has changed since the mid-1920s, when the automobile starts to have a big impact. People moved to the suburbs. They, began shopping in shopping centers. That becomes a kind of an alternative space. And so in a lot of communities, the plazas have lost their vitality. I think the ones that are strongest have tourism as one of the components. You can kind of think of Taos, Santa Fe, Albuquerque, Mesilla, as the examples of that. One of the things that's going on, and really one of the reasons we did the book, is that because of the challenges of sustainability, of fossil fuel depletion, of global warming, there's a whole movement. It goes under various names: new urbanism, smart growth, sustainable communities. We're going to have to develop alternatives which are a little bit denser, which are tied to mass transit, better mass transit. And one of the things we're saying is that for that to be an attractive alternative, we need to rediscover some of the things that gave quality of life to people living in those denser situations earlier. And one of the key things is to have a signature public space for everyday enjoyment and for a kind of expression of community identity. And, you know, we'll talk more about Santa Fe's Plaza, but it's kind of an ultimate example of a great set of public celebrations and events.
It's interesting that you say that one of the things that keeps a plaza kind of alive and successful is tourism, because one of the just almost cliche things that you hear about Santa Fe and about New Mexico Plaza, particularly Santa Fe, is, oh, we used to go shopping there. We used to have the Woolworths and the shoe store and everything there, and now it's just a bunch of tourist stores, and it's not real anymore.
What's a different space? I mean, I grew up in that Santa Fe. You went down and you bought your Levi's, you bought your clothes there. But it was also the focal point of different communities, different celebrations, and it's always been kind of a space. It's the confluence of the multiple cultures in New Mexico. Still, we have, you know, Spanish market, we have Indian market. We do have an influx of tourism, and that's sort of what has made it more viable. It's, you know, it's as a community, and I think one of the things that the book cites is that the plazas are constantly evolving, and the ones that evolve the best to function within the needs of the community work best. You know, Santa Fe is still the plaza is a very contested space. There used to be a high school down there. There used to be a mid school down there. And, you know, the kids would come to the plaza. Well, that created problems in the 60s, so they changed the identity. Then it became like the shopping mall, and it always was that. Then we build, you know, DeVargas Center, and suddenly that focal point changes, and then it evolves into what's become an important part of the economy of Santa Fe. But yet it's still a contested space. It's a space where the kids hang out in the summer. It's a kid, you know, it's a place, you know, I show pictures, and you can immediately, I say, plaza rats. And everybody who grew up in Santa Fe of the last, you know, 15 or 20 years, at a college students or whatever, they all know the plaza rats, because that's a community that still uses the space. The pet parade still goes by there. The museum's still there. The Palace of the Governors, of course, and the market. Yeah, it's touristy, but it's also still a vibrant core that people rally around in Santa Fe.
Well, and all the music there, like Santa Fe Bandstand.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody goes out sooner or later and goes dancing or listening to music in that space.
Yeah, and it's a great example of you know, urban design in a sense. Stefanos Palazoides, one of the editors of the book with Chris, really opened my eyes. You know, I grew up here, so I think, well, yeah, this is Santa Fe, and all cities are like this. First time I traveled out of Santa Fe and went to places that didn't have flat roofs or didn't have something else. But it was really interesting, because when this started as a part of a class that Chris and Stefanos taught, we were in the Santa Fe Plaza, and he was comparing it to the Rambla in Barcelona and saying, this is a great example of urban design. Well, you know, it opened my eyes, and I think the book is meant to open eyes of people on the viability of the plaza, the territorial square, and even the Pueblo plazas, and how we can learn from them. And Santa Fe's one that works really, really well.
We're talking to Chris Wilson and Miguel Gandert about the book, The Plazas of New Mexico. One of the things that, it's one of those moments where something that's really obvious but you never noticed just comes popping out of your book, which is that cultural identity, how we define ourselves, is based so much on how we spend our time and what we call important. And if that, how we spend our time and what we call important, happens in public spaces as opposed to, you know, around the dinner table or in your backyard, those are very big differences in culture.
Well, I think so, and I think the Occupy Wall Street, you know, Occupy America that's going on now, you know, an attempt at political mobilization to challenge the maldistribution of wealth in this country and political power, gravitates to public space. You know, if you don't have public space, you know, not only do you not have a face-to-face community, but you can't really have a democracy. And, you know, shopping malls have the right to prohibit political speech, you know, so, you know, folks aren't going there. You know, they're going to the parks, they're going to the streets, they're going to the public spaces.
Yeah, it's very interesting because when you talk about political change, it always goes back to saying nothing's going to happen until people take to the streets. And whatever you do, signing petitions from the coziness of your laptop or whatever, it's not the same as going outside and being together in one way or another. Whether that be protest, whether that be dancing, listening to music, whether that be hanging out. I mean, I'd rather be a plaza rat than a mall rat, because it's fundamentally non-commercial public space in which, within the boundaries of the law, you can do whatever you want.
There's a great contestation going on. And I think the way Chris tied it into what's going on Wall Street, I mean, they're occupying space at UNM, not at Civic Plaza, which is in Albuquerque, which is an inhumane design of a public space where people come for music, but you'd never go there to hang out because of the concrete. And the Santa Fe, you know, people complain, you have to replace the lawn every year. Well, that's part of having a public space. That's part of having a place that the community will come together. You know, and it does have its sense of protest. There's a couple of photographs in the book about an AIDS walk that starts where? You start at the plaza, you end at the plaza. You know, those are the spaces that people identify with Santa Fe. And they are just so alive. And they're where civilization happens. I mean, and I think that's one of the things we hope. The book has over 100 historic photographs. It has almost 100 of my photographs. And then it has drawings. And it's like sort of meant to be a primer for how we can look at these places and learn fundamentally how to use this. I think architecture for the long time, you know, wanted to say we could build buildings that change the world, not realizing that in the modernist mode where you build masterpieces, well, that's really exciting. But it's almost more important the spaces around the buildings in which people can be.
Right.
People can exist is what this book is really about and meant to examine.
It's an extraordinary book. I mean, I was reading through this and looking at the pictures and the drawings and the photographs and everything, and the old ones and the new ones. And one of the things that was really striking about it to me was that, Miguel, your photographs, they blend so nicely with the historic photographs. And it made me feel like there's such a continuity here in New Mexico between the old and the contemporary. And it's not just because you take primarily black and white photographs, but it's like we're the same people in the same spaces evolving. But I was thinking if you had the old and the new in some city back east, it would be like night and day. You could barely recognize it.
Well, in a lot of places, the plazas are gone. I mean, Tucson had two great plazas, and they were urban renewed out of existence. You know,
right.
So if you go, in some places, you find a parking lot if you go looking for the old plaza. And so we're really fortunate not only to have a plaza like the one in Santa Fe, which is as important a public space as any other in the United States. It's got a 400-year history. It's just incredibly rich. But in the book, we identify and we document about 70 of these community spaces. And they're all across the state, and many of them are in decline. You know, many of them are holding on, but I think they have the bones of, you know, community public space and of walkable, you know, denser community nodes.
I think one of the things that was interesting to me, and it's nice to hear you say that about the photographs, that they feel like they're timeless. I mean, the only thing that we really did was I picked a specific camera that would do long, thin frames because I think it helped articulate the space. But what the drawings and the different diagrams and things freed me up to put people into the spaces so that the photographs shot primarily with wide angle are layered, so you see the plaza behind it. You see a buildings behind it. You see the layers of space. But because of the camera, it allowed me also to look at and examine the intimate ways that people use, you know, from the plaza rats to La Conquistadora or Nuestra Señora de la Paz coming through for fiesta. You know, all of those kinds of uses got to be in a part of the book, and those linked with the old pictures of the fiesta parade and the old pictures of how, and seeing how Santa Fe's changed, but fundamentally the design has worked for each generation that's gone
through
it.
You know, it's been a real pleasure and a privilege to work with Miguel and to see the way that he works, because he basically puts people at ease, you know, and he steps into
you
the social
tell, yeah.
the social situational frame, you know. So if the frame is three young women on the Santa Fe Plaza sitting down near the monument, he's able to come up, become a part of that social circle. And so what you're seeing in the photograph is the frame of social interaction, and you're stepping into that frame.
And you're seeing also a lot of music. I guess you like taking pictures of musicians?
Well, music and ritual is really important to me. I mean, my first big book was Nuevo México Profundo that primarily focused on ritual throughout the Rio Grande Corridor. Somehow Santa Fe wasn't in that book. It was really interesting to me, the town I grew up in, because I needed another frame to find Santa Fe, and the frame became the plaza. And there's a lot more pictures that aren't in the book, which is always the hard part of the book. But yeah, we were there for Fiesta, we were there for AIDS Walk, we were there for, you know, Spanish Market. You know, it's just an amazing kind of different things. It's really hard to photograph Indian Market because it is so crowded. I mean, the space becomes almost the population of the city of Albuquerque.
Right, right. Now, let's talk a little bit about the Santa Fe Plaza and the history and evolution of that space.
Well, sure. The plaza is probably laid out in 1610, when Oñate, you know, sets up the capital here, follows the Spanish laws of the Indies, which were a set of town planning ordinances. It was originally a long rectangle that stretched all the way up to where the cathedral is now. And the precursor of the cathedral was a little bit north over where Cathedral Place Park, if that's what it's called, so that it was on the middle of the high side of the plaza. Then, of course, with the Pueblo Revolt of 1680, the Spanish survivors of the revolt flee south to El Paso del Norte, and Piro and Tewa, Pueblo Indians from the Galisteo Basin and the Espanola Valley, occupy Santa Fe. They're there for 13 years, and of course they're going to follow their cultural patterns. So they develop a multi-story terraced pueblo with two plazas and with a kiva in each one of those. So when the Spanish come back, they struggle to reassert their image of what Santa Fe should be. And that's probably the root of how the plaza got whittled down to the current square from the larger rectangle. It's a Spanish governmental center, so people with all kinds of petitions and wishes and grievances make their way to the plaza, to the governor, with their petitions for land grants. In the early 1840s, there's a delegation of Ute Indians who come down from what's now the New Mexico-Colorado border because some of their people have been killed by Spanish traders going through there. And they, they're petitioning for some kind of monetary redress for the loss of these people. And it's interesting because there are two stories. The one that Governor Martinez, at that time, reports is, well, you know, they were unruly and they attacked us, and so we had to fight back and drive them out of the town. Well, there's an oral tradition that lives on up on that northern New Mexico border that talks about the governor having hid troops behind a tapestry, and they fall upon them in the palace of the governor. So, you know, the disagreement.
Right, right.
You know, and that, I mean, that's one of, you know, there you could cite 20 historical episodes that are as rich and riveting as that.
And the use of the plaza, I mean, Fiesta, for example, kind of fell into decline to where it wasn't happening at all and then got revived, what, 100 years ago or approximately?
Yeah, the proclamation for the Fiesta in the early 1700s was a commemoration of the Reconquest. And it did fall into decline. And then in 1911, 1912, 1919, the community, headed by the Museum of New Mexico, develops a fiesta, which is cast, you know, in historical terms, and, you know, very important expression of Hispanic cultural identity. It's also, and so much of culture, you know, we want to think that there's a kind of an authenticity that doesn't change. Well, in fact, there was a historical pageant movement around the country and even internationally, with people doing enactments of events from their history. And it's in that period, 1905 to 1915. And the Santa Fe Fiesta started out with 3 days, one enacting Pueblo culture, one Hispanic, one Anglo. And there was a kind of evolutionary progress of civilization implicit in these things. And the Indian Day very quickly shifted to the August Indian Market as a separate event. And then the Anglo Day, you know, which was commemorating General Kearney occupying Santa Fe, was kind of unsettling for people. And so after 2 or 3 years, they let that part go, and that's how it became not a full historical pageant, but focused on the Reconquest as the reenactment.
It also, when you talk about that, it brings up this question for me of how we know our history. So in the days before the barrage of television and movies and just the infinite number of stories that we have coming at us every day, it seems like there might have been a time where the stories that we knew and the stories that really defined us might happen in pageants on the plaza.
Well, you know, I think the great thing about, really, if you look at the plaza and you read it as if it were a text, there are so many different histories that are our history, and it's a different kind of living history. You know, the monument in the center and the monument where the word, I think, what is it, savages, Chris, is etched out of the stone.
Right.
You know, that commemorates and how that becomes a part of the dialogue. Different people assert ownership, not just permanently, but on different days and different times. So it becomes a living embodiment of the different layers of history, whether you're seeing, you know, Mexican music on the plaza or a bluegrass band or a rock and roll band. It's all present, and it's a living history, and it's very different from the kind of history that our young people a lot of times are getting by sitting in front of a computer.
Right.
And it's a living place that breathes. It draws us in. It's just vital to what, and I think that's why Chris originally conceived the project.
Well, and there are these sets of mytho-historic ritual celebrations in the Hispanic villages and also in some of the pueblos, Los Comanches, Los Marochines, which are about New Mexico history. They're about the raiding between the Hispanic and Pueblo villages and the Comanches. They're about the two cultures mixing. They're about conquest. They're about mestizaje, about the racial and cultural mixing. And these are public celebrations enacted year after year. And so the kids that grow up in those communities, they learn their history as a story, but they learn it as a ritual. And as a ritual which is symbolically ambiguous, symbolically rich, that people, I mean, it almost becomes a kind of community shared, you know, subconscious memory.
The book is called The Plazas of New Mexico. Chris Wilson is author, I guess co-author. There's various people who have written essays in this wonderful book. And Miguel Gandert is photographer. There are also many historical photographs. A panel discussion about this book will be happening this Sunday, the 16th of October at 2 o'clock at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium here in Santa Fe. It's free. It's open to the public. There's a book signing. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Well, thanks for having
thanks
us.
Thanks for having us.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.